This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio here. When the people speak, we make a difference. I'm really pleased to have our guest with us tonight. David Swanson is an American author as well as a blogger and an anti-war activist. He served as press secretary for Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich in the 2004 presidential election and was a key figure in making the Downing Street memo known across America. It was that memo that leaked the minutes of the meeting of the British War Cabinet, exposed the lies behind the war in Iraq, and was a key element in turning the majority of American people against the war in Iraq. Hi, David. Tonight we're going to be talking about your book, War is a Lie.
Hi, Basma. Great to be here, and that sounds good.
And I need not remind everyone, David Swanson also hosted our show for quite some time, and I really appreciate that. We enjoyed having you with us, David.
Oh, I enjoyed every minute of it. I haven't been doing my own radio show for quite a long time. Up until just this past week, I started a new show called Talk Nation Radio.
Oh, wonderful. You'll have to give me the details so I can tune in.
Yeah, talknationradio.com. It was actually hosted for years very well by Jory Smith, and now she's having me host it instead.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Well, I will definitely tune in. And, you know, while we're on, when do you air, David, just so people can listen in?
Well, it's a half-hour show once a week, and it's syndicated by Pacifica, and it airs on all kinds of stations at all kinds of times. But you can listen to it, if you have a computer, anytime you want at TalkNationRadio.com or DavidSwanson.org or any other place that has podcasts.
Well, there you go. Now make sure you tune in to some of David's broadcasts. I'm sure you'll be fascinated by the overwhelming exposure and ability to expose lies in this day of lies. And war is a lie, David, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, I've run into maybe six people since I wrote this book that wanted to assure me that wars really did exist. And of course, what I was arguing in the book was not that wars did not exist, but that everything we tell each other about them is a lie. The reasons offered for starting wars, for continuing wars, for escalating wars, for beautifying wars after they're over, and for keeping the machinery in place that builds the momentum for wars is all a fabric of lies. And there are a limited number of types so that people become familiar with them, and you start to see the same lies being told about Iran, for example, that you've become familiar with on Iraq. And it gets very old, but it's a matter of life and death to keep telling each other that it's all lies. Well, we've got a majority of the American public right now believing Iran has nuclear weapons and wants to use them on us. While all of our, top officials in Washington swear it isn't true and they don't really mean to suggest it, our televisions are very clearly suggesting it all day long.
Exactly. You know, I find it interesting. This was the funny thing that I think about Iran whenever I think about it. The decision to attack Iran was in the works for many, many years. As far as what we have done with our troops in the area, when they're currently surrounding Iran in full force, we have over 20,000 troops in Jordan, about 20 or 30 are bordering the Syrian border. on the North Face, and we have one of the largest American naval bases in the world at the southern end of Iran. And all day long, our presidential incoming candidates advocate war on Iran openly, and people are actually believe that Iran is threatening us. Who's threatening who here?
Well, other than the possible connection between Hezbollah or Hamas and Iran and so forth, Iran as a nation has not attacked another nation in literally centuries, literally since it's been called Iran. It has not attacked another nation, nor is it threatening to do so, nor does it have nuclear weapons. Israel and the United States have nuclear weapons, openly threaten war on other nations, launch embargoes, to blockade the economy of the nation of Iran, which is an act of war, have murdered scientists on the streets of Tehran, which is an act of war, have funded, both the United States and Israel, have funded organizations in Iran that engage in violence, including organizations identified by our own government as terrorist organizations. So our government needs to lock itself up for material support of terrorism. The irony is, it would be so humorous if it weren't so deadly. The largest military ever known in the world is complaining that a small state halfway around the globe that wants to be left alone is threatening to attack us if we attack it. And therefore, we need to attack it because that's outrageous that they would suggest they would fight back. It's sad that anyone would fall for such nonsense, and it's to the credit of the American people that a majority have been resisting this for years now, but those numbers appear to be slipping.
David, obviously you've researched this topic thoroughly, and since Iran is one of the going to be, I believe that the decision has already been made to attack Iran. It's just a matter of when we're going to attack Iran. So, but why are we going to attack Iran?
Well, there are many in Washington and in the military and in the Senate that want to attack Iran, and the sooner the better. And the war is absolutely the first resort, not the last. There are others who very much don't want to or are leaning against it or on the fence. You have the President of the United States urging against attacking Iran while continuing to push the lies about Iran's threat to us and their nuclear weapons program and their obligation to prove a negative and show that they don't have what we will swear they have no matter what, and the president's steadfast refusal to actually threaten Israel with anything Israel cares about, which could be so easily done, in order to dissuade it from attacking. We're now at the point, just in the past day, of Iran apparently threatening a preemptive strike against the West, against Israel or the United States, if it feels it is about to be struck. So you have mutual threats of preemptive strikes, right? What could go wrong? The momentum is carrying us forward into a war, even if nobody wants it. And that momentum comes from a military-industrial complex that is incredibly profitable, that funds think tanks and strategists that long for the military domination of regions and control of natural resources. If Iran did not have oil, this would not be happening. If Iran's government were cooperating with Washington and the Pentagon, this would not be happening. If Iran was populated by white English-speaking Christians, this would not be happening. But there's not a rational explanation. When we're threatening to cut off their oil and they're threatening us back with cutting off their oil, it's become about ego and power trips. And you cannot hope to find a full rational explanation for the madness of war.
Well, I agree with you that there is no rational explanation for the madness of war in itself, but I don't agree necessarily that a war with Iran is irrational. I think it's very rational. If you want strategic dominance in the region, you need to take out the people that have the potential to become the most powerful. And that
well,
would be
how
Iran.
Will you do
so,
that? Will you
well,
kill
by warring
75
them
million people?
And destroying them.
Well, I don't dispute that there are goals that realpolitik, neocon warmongers have and that they themselves view as rational. They want to dominate the globe. They want to seize the resources. But look how well things are going in Afghanistan. Look how things worked out in Iraq. Unless you were a war profiteer, unless you were an oil corporation, unless you were a cleanup operation, unless you profited directly in the short term from that madness, you as part of the corporate power structure in the United States suffered from that war. The general population of the United States, of course, suffered from that war, and the globe suffered from increased hostilities, environmental destruction, weapons proliferation, a path that is going to eventually, sooner rather than later, destroy us all. So at some point it ceases to be rational to continue down a path that threatens major, if not global, destruction.
Well, you know, I would love to go a tip for tat on this one because I'll be honest with you. I think it would be fun for people that are on the same side to reach different conclusions, but ultimately come out, you know, with a mutual understanding of each other's side. I often wonder if our governments really care about our societies as much as we give them credit for. So that, I guess, is a question that will eventually be determined in and of itself. You call your book, War is a Lie, almost a manual, David. What kind of handbook? What would this handbook be used for?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't give our government credit for caring about our society as far as I could throw the United States Capitol. So I'm sorry for that misimpression. I intend War is a Lie as a manual for war prevention, for war preparedness, preparing to prevent future wars. If the vast majority of the American public opposes a war and sees through the lies that are leading up to a major war and opposes it passionately enough and strategically enough, we can prevent wars. It is when they manage to persuade a significant portion of the public that a war is either desirable or tolerable that they're able to get wars started, after which it's virtually impossible to end them. It takes years and years of intense pressure and, of course, their own realization that they're losing the war on its own terms for wars to be ended, because it becomes all about this insanity of continuing a war for the sake of the young men and women that we're pushing into it, to support the troops nonsense. And so we have to prevent major wars before they begin to happen, and the way you do that is to see through the lies that are preparing the ground, the lie that a war should be started because some other nation might have weapons of some kind, the lies that other nation is behind crazy secret plots to hire a Texas car salesman, to hire a Mexican drug gang, to kill a Saudi ambassador in Washington, and so forth. Denouncing all those lies on the spot as transparent repetitions of lies we've become familiar with over the centuries is a very powerful tool in resisting war.
So your hope is, at least, that given armed with information, armed with the understanding and the truth, that we will be able to diminish these events.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the book is not, War is a Lie is not entirely for everyone who's already in the chorus to help them sing louder. I mean, it's also for people who are undecided about war and think there might be some good wars and some bad wars. It's an attempt to persuade those people of the economic disadvantages of war, the disadvantages in terms of civil liberties, of the natural environment, and of course of public safety. Wars being something that even for those not directly taking part endanger us rather than making us more safe. So that if we can win more of our fellow men and women and children over to that side, we can begin to dismantle the argument that says we need to keep putting $1 trillion a year into preparation in case there's a good war coming around next month. We know lots of these wars are bad wars, but there might be a good war next month. If we can take that away, then, my God, we have the resources to live as well as the Scandinavians or better. We're the wealthiest nation in the world. We just put it all into battleships and billionaires, and we don't have to.
Well, I certainly agree with you that I don't believe that in this day and age there is any reason for nations to war. And one of the things that I'm so concerned about, David, and I don't know if you address this in your book, is this convoluted understanding of war, why we go to war, and what is in it for America to go into these foreign wars? How do we convince people that this is just some kind of a delusion that we're under?
Well, you know, for more than a century now, we haven't gone into wars, you know, in order to seize slaves or territory or loot or to enrich our nation in that sort of direct sense, much less to, you know, eat our opponents, as used to be the procedure. Wars in the modern age, which have virtually ceased between major, wealthy, powerful nations, and have become wars between the powerful nations and the poor nations. Wars are now promoted as either humanitarian, either philanthropic. They're good. You know, these people are better off for being bombed. We're going to help them along, or they're presented as protection against a vast evil conspiracy. For a while, it tended to be the Soviet commie conspiracy. Lately, it's the Muslim terrorist global terrorism conspiracy. But often it's a combination of these, so that you have a certain segment of the U.S. public, for example, that wants to go after the dirty, evil Muslim terrorists, which are transformed into the entire population of some nation, which should be wiped off the face of the earth, with a great deal of religious bigotry and racism, and another section of the population that wants to go do the very same thing, but for their good, to help them out, so their women can have better rights and so forth, which of course would, you know, this week be a great argument for Iran to bomb my state of Virginia, except that when you bomb women, you actually violate their right to live as well as all their other rights. So they're crazy arguments, and they're even crazier in combination. But they seem to be just enough, combined with a lot of misinformation and secrecy, to get wars going.
It is amazing, and it is still disturbing no matter how much information we get. We do have a caller on line three, David. Caller, your name and your question for David Swanson, author of War is a Lie.
Hi, this is Mike from California. I know David well. We worked on an impeach Bush campaign, and I totally agree with him. War is a lie, but if war is a lie, then that makes Congress and perhaps president promoters of lies and betrayers of the American people's trust. And that's the next question. What do you do about those liars?
Well, you build a movement to throw them out. You at some point you have to have accountability, as of course the movement for impeachment was. Needless to say, the current president merits impeachment just as the previous, and the candidates running in the Republican Party now are begging to be preemptively impeached. But at some point, these people need to be prosecuted as well. I just attended a long conference at a university in D.C. with people from around the world, lawyers and doctors who work on the issue of torture, and they're dealing with the problem of torture spreading around the world and its acceptance growing, promoted by the United States and Hollywood, and the impunity that the United States gives to its most powerful people for their crimes, and that lesson spreading across the world, and these activists telling each other that the only thing that's going to work to stop torture is accountability, is people up at the highest levels being held accountable for the crime of torture. And they're talking about the need for democracy instead of dictatorship in these dozens of nations around the world we're discussing. But of course, we come back to the United States, and we have a former president and a former vice president with best-selling book tours, with books in which they openly confess to authorizing the waterboarding of human beings, which is, of course, nothing compared to the wars they authorized that have left at least a million people dead, millions of refugees, tens of millions of people injured, traumatized, their lives destroyed. The crime is so vast that to have no accountability for it is the most dangerous thing we're playing around with. And to have a president like Obama, who devotes such resources to protecting his predecessors and formalizing the powers to do as they did, we have gone down a very, very dangerous path that many of us foresaw several years ago, and we've been able to do very little about it in terms of the formal structure of what has become legal in Washington, D.C.
David, can you tell us how tell our audience how we can get your book, and what are the best places to do this?
You can get any of my books from your local independent bookstore or Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and you can go to davidswanson.org and find War is a Lie and a number of other books.
And your blog is also on that same website, David?
Yeah, davidswanson.org is where I blog, and many other places, including warisacrime.org.
So there you go, folks. Now, before we leave, David, can you tell us briefly, how are your feelings about some of the Republican candidates that are coming in that are that absolutely advocate war on Iran, absolutely, with no and they have no shame about it?
Well, of course, you can't put Ron Paul in that list, but you can put the rest of them in it, and you can put the current president pretty darn close to that same list. We are going to continue down an absolutely catastrophic course in terms of the concentration of wealth and power, the enrichment and empowerment of an obscenely wealthy and absolutely immoral elite, of war, growth, and proliferation, and of environmental destruction. Whether the next president is Obama or Romney or Santorum or any of the rest of that crowd, unless we build a massive people's movement, the Occupy movement is a great start, to turn things around through public pressure, through nonviolent action in between and apart from elections. And if we do that, then we could have actually a second term Obama that was worth writing home about, or a Romney or Santorum who was better than the first term Obama. I mean, this is the big factor here, is not what face is in the White House, but as Howard Zinn taught us, you know, rather than who's sitting in the White House, it's a question of who's doing the sitting in that is going to change our society. And so rather than, you know, promoting the obsession with elections, let's remember that Emma Goldman was right. If elections alone changed anything, they would be banned. And the movements of the past have been right to not go down that road. Dr. Martin Luther King, whose holiday we celebrated not too long back, never fell in behind a party, never endorsed a candidate, and was very seldom accused of not being serious for that failure, because he was doing much more serious and effective work. So, you know, frankly, I it's a question at this point of whether we have the, you know, the racist, religious, buffoon warmonger or the African-American warmonger, right? It, you know, either
it's
way,
a pretty sad,
we're done for.
Pretty sad scenario.
Right. Neither one should be acceptable. And I don't care how rational it is to choose the lesser evil every 4 years. It is also rational to notice that every 4 years you have two choices who are both more evil than the most evil guy the last time.
Exactly.
And so
it is no longer
path.
The lesser of two evils. It's just an equal balance of evil going on in our society and our presidential candidates today. David, thank you very much for being with us. David Swanson, author of War is a Lie. Go to his site, get his book. Let's have David Swanson run for president. I would vote for you, David. And I appreciate your candor. I appreciate the fact that you are informing people adequately with this information. David Swanson,
well, thank
folks.
You. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to be taking a break, and our next guest will be forthcoming, David Rovix, musician extraordinaire. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, folks.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine having banks and credit that serve the community, solvent and free of Wall Street corruption, that create strong local economy and job growth? Banks that put profits right back into the local business and economy, not into far-off foreign investments or high-risk and exotic finance schemes of the super-rich.
Yes, we can.
Can you imagine eliminating income tax, ensuring economic stability, increasing social programs, and improving the standard of living for all Americans while paying off the federal debt?
Yes, we can.
That's right. It's all possible.
Yes.
Can you join us in working towards a solution utilizing principles suggested by our founding fathers through united action and strategies outlined in articles, blogs, and wiki spaces where you can share and collaborate?
Uh-huh.
Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, and help us make America's money and future of, by, and for the people once again. Can you do that?
Yes, we can.
Caution. If you are prone to being disturbed by real truth and real solutions, please continue to consult with your qualified Wall Street cheerleader economist on network television. Side effects for not visiting webofdebt.com include drowsiness, loss of job, loss of control of national finance, loss of country, followed by panic attacks and rude awakenings.
Web of Debt has now been translated into Spanish, titled
Telaraña de Deuda,
available on Amazon.com
or at telaranadedeuda.org.
Hader Adnan grew up near Jenin City. could say he was a product of his time. Ever since he was a kid, he'd get arrested, though he was never charged with any crime. Spending half his life in prison, a life lived like so many of his friends. Arbitrary and indefinite detention, never knowing if your jail time would end. Kader Adnan was arrested last December. Again, he wasn't told the reason why. He was shackled, he was beaten, he was tortured. There beneath the Middle Eastern sky, perhaps there was a moment when he realized that right then, with his body, he'd say no. But from then on, he refused to eat another meal, like in Belfast not many years ago. Kader Adnan grew up in a war zone, but all the tanks and planes were only on one side. It was a type of war that they call occupation, settlement, removal, fratricide. And anyone who talked about resistance, who thought they did not deserve to be a slave, would be looking down the barrel of a gun, and often find themselves inside an early grave. Kader Adnan loves his wife and children, and he likes to eat his daily bread. But in prison, he can't see his daughters or live life with the lady that he wed. So on behalf of all the children without fathers, he decided he had to strike a blow. He said, I will have dignity or death, like in Belfast not many years ago. Each time Kader Adnan was arrested, in prison he would learn a little more, and soon he became the teacher, and he'd talk about the times that came before. They talked about civil disobedience, they talked about the ballot and the gun, they talked about the occupied six counties and the H blocks in 1981. Kader Adnan talked of perseverance and how someday their people might be free, how someday they might hear their children laughing unafraid, how someday things could be. And then at 3:30 on one morning, the soldiers came, their rifles pointed low, and they took Kader Adnan from his family, like in Belfast not many years ago. They say Kader Adnan is a terrorist, just like they said of Bobby Sands, because he dares speak out against injustice, because he dares to make a stand, because he dares believe that he is human, and he does not deserve to live this way, because he dares to consider an alternative, because he dares to imagine a new day. Kader Adnan lost his liberty before he was born. To fight for life, it's death he must embrace. But like others come before him, there are others who take his place. And even the great powers can lose interest in supporting such a vicious status quo, because you can't break a man who won't be broken, like in Belfast not many years ago. Like in Belfast not many years ago.
Wow. Thank you very much. Welcome. Thank you. And welcome, David Rovix, musician extraordinaire. Incredible song, David. Welcome to the People Speak Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
David Brovix grew up in a family of classical musicians in Connecticut and became a fan of populist regimes early on. By the early 1990s, he was a full-time busker in Boston. Now, you're going to have to explain what a busker is. In Boston subways. What is that?
It's a British term for street musician, which is known in some places in the U.S. but not others. You know, it depends on whether there is much busking going on. Like in places like Boston, or I imagine New Orleans, you know, people would know the term, but not necessarily everywhere.
Well, I have to admit, there's not a lot of terms that I haven't heard, and this is one of them.
But
welcome to the show, David. David, this is an incredible song, incredible lyrics. And as long as mankind has been protesting, there have been fasting in response to inhumanity, in response to occupation, in response to war, into response to injustice. How did you decide to write this song, David?
Well, I had only actually just kind of heard about Khadr Adnan and his hunger strike, and last week, and then I got a message on Facebook from a guy I met named Saad Abu Hijla in Nablus when I was in the West Bank in Palestine in 2005, and he said you have to write a song about this man, and he doesn't regularly give me orders, so I you know dropped everything I was doing and started reading about him and he had sent Saad had sent me a link to an article in the Independent in England about comparing Khadr Adnan to Bobby Sands, which was in so many ways a very apt comparison because, well, for one thing, they both Bobby Sands died at 66 days, and Adnan called off his hunger strike apparently this morning at 66 on the 66th day after the High Court said that he get out early, although they didn't actually let him out, but they made his release date a bit sooner. And of course, both of them were hunger striking over similar kinds of reasons. I mean, being treated so inhumanely in the prison system there, both protesting what in Israel they call administrative detention, which is holding people without trial indefinitely as often as you like, which was also the British practice in Northern Ireland in the early 70s. And there's a lot of similarities between the British occupation of Northern Ireland at that time and the Israeli occupation of Palestine today.
Well, I know for a fact that I have a lot of friends that have lit candles, Irish friends that have lit candles for Khadr Adnan in solidarity with exactly this kind of effect, the Bobby Sands effect. Khadr Adnan and Bobby Sands both were willing to die for what they believed in, and for those of you that don't understand the nature of peaceful resistance, this is a peaceful way of resisting inhumane treatment. Fasting is considered a peaceful method. Isn't it unfortunate, though, that we have to go to such lengths? And, you know, all this time, neither Bobby Sands nor Adnan had ever been charged with any crime. But according to the High Court in Israel, even upon agreeing to release Khadr Adnan at the appropriate time, this time, they said that they are still going to hold back because he's a dangerous terrorist, although they haven't charged him with anything. They just assume that they can call anybody they please a terrorist. And he's a dangerous terrorist, and unless secret information is revealed or becomes apparent. I love that. I wonder what kind of secret information is going to, and if it's a secret, I'm sure that nobody in Palestine and nobody in Khadr's family and nobody in the world or the media will ever know what the secret stuff is. But yeah. Excuse me, but they will keep him in prison because of the secret information. So we don't know what's going to happen. I often wonder, on his 66th day, Bobby Sands died. So one would have to wonder the condition, the medical condition that Khadr Adnan is currently in.
Oh, it's terrible. I mean, he's apparently, even though he stopped his hunger strike, he's still at risk of dying any minute because of organ failure after he go that long without eating. Yeah, for sure.
Exactly. But, and I'm just wondering if maybe the Israeli government and the high courts knew this, David, and just didn't want to have to go make him a martyr, so they agreed to, you know. And now if he dies, it's just another death, another Palestinian death.
Sure.
Now, you said in a week you've written this song, and it's already become so extremely popular, David, as well it should. These kinds of songs must become popular. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, it's popularity is all relative, but I wrote it between Saturday afternoon and finished it Sunday morning, and then put it up on YouTube, a primitive recording, that the one that you played on the show, and then within about 24 hours, it had been viewed more than 10,000 times. But I mean, of course, that's there are plenty of YouTube videos of cats meowing strangely and getting many times as many views as that in 24 hours. So popular is just a very relative idea, but it's certainly got a lot more attention than most songs that I put up. Certainly that's has a lot to do with mostly the sort of urgency of the situation, and also people, I think, involved with sort of internet media or terrestrial media or whatever, all
terrestrial.
Wanting.
Yeah, I like that.
The
terrestrial and the interterrestrial media.
Yeah, that's true. What does that mean? Internet, extraterrestrial maybe, but yeah, they're all looking for content, as they're trying to write a new story about Adnan's hunger strike each day. So, probably that was useful in them picking up on the song.
Well, are you going to be going on tour anytime soon, David?
I'll be spending, from the end of this month until mid-May, I'll be on tour all over Europe, and then I'll be back in the U.S. in mid-May for the NATO G8 conference in Chicago. And, it should be mentioned, Bobby Sands was not being held in administrative detention at the time that he was on hunger strike. He had been convicted, whether fairly or not, for all sorts of armed related offenses. But of course, in both cases, regardless of whether they're guilty of offenses or not, and in Adnan's case, they had nothing, seemed to have nothing on him. But in both cases, they're fighting against an occupation of their land, if they're fighting at all, And of course, in Adnan's case, it wasn't even that, they're just holding him for apparently nothing, which they can do. But although that practice in Northern Ireland was stopped by the British, I think in 1974, when they stopped the policy of indefinite detention without trial. Although, of course, this policy has been revived by none other than the United States, in Guantanamo.
Is this the first song you've written in relation to Palestine?
No, it's the 19th.
Well, there you go, folks. I guess if you do it often enough, you're bound to break through the Israeli boycott of everything Palestinian.
Yeah, they even covered the song in the Jerusalem Post.
Wonderful. Yeah. Congratulations. Yeah. Are you going to be incorporating this song in your tour?
Oh, yeah, of course. I'll be singing it on the tour. Yeah.
That's wonderful. The lyrics are amazing. You're also a writer. You've been regularly published in Counterpunch and other online sites. Can you tell us what you generally write about?
Usually politics, but oftentimes when I'm writing an essay about it, I often kind of stick to stuff that I have direct experience in. Like, if it's, you know, about something that I, the music industry, or about a place that I recently visited, or it's, so they're kind of like, it's kind of like political analysis / travel writing.
Why don't you perform it in Israel? Maybe that, well, but then we would get some real notoriety.
I did actually do a tour in Israel, and I had an entire tour in Israel canceled as well the following year, because in between the tour in Israel and having the tour canceled, I wrote a song about Palestinians, and they didn't like that. Most of the people didn't like that who had booked me in the Israeli folk music scene. But I did gain a lot more Palestinian fans than I ever had in Israel. So, you know, it all worked out fine for me. But that tour was canceled. I did do a few years later a tour in the West Bank, though. That was fantastic.
Well, I'll tell you, as a Palestinian, I have to tell you, we Palestinians make the best fans in the world anyway.
Absolutely.
I bet you didn't know I was a Palestinian, huh?
I didn't. No. Although the Belfast crowd is very that's a very good.
I have to admit, those Irish know how to party.
yeah, they do.
Sounds like you're going to have a wonderful experience with this. I hope that this, it being the 19th, that it isn't your last. I can see that you have a sense of justice about you, about your music, that these words came easily to you, means that you're talking from a person, from a spirit that is in touch with, as our previous guest, David Swanson's book suggests, war is a lie, and we don't have to engage in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is. I think it's actually really easy to write about Palestine if you want to. I mean, of course, it's you'll have a lot of doors closed in your face as far as any possibilities of jobs in journalism or music or whatever else, but the situation in Palestine, the history and the current events, I mean, there's so much about it that is just so, it's so primal, it's so iconic, you know, it's so much filled with metaphor, filled with history. I mean, the comparisons between occupation of Northern Ireland, the occupation in Palestine, the fact that it's home to three major religions. And I mean, there's just so much about it that, you know, the fact that you have, of course, a city that's founded by refugees largely from Europe, who then, in the course of founding their country, create millions more refugees. You know, the fact that these people who survived concentration camps are now creating, a variety of concentration camp in places like Gaza and the West to hold their open air prisoners in, you know, the Palestinians there. It's that there are just so many parallels that are just, you wouldn't be able to make it up. It would make bad fiction because people would be like, you know, that's too obvious. Well, you can't just escape from the Warsaw ghetto and then put Gaza into a ghetto. I mean, you know, who would really do that in reality? It makes it, you know, it just doesn't even seem realistic. Like, if you're writing a book about it, but there it is. It's reality, and it's poetic in a very terrible way, but it certainly lends itself to poetry.
Are you going to be going anywhere in the area of Palestine on your tour at all?
Now, this tour is pretty much all Northern Europe. Like, mm-hmm. I won't be anywhere further south than Switzerland.
And have you heard of from any of Khadr's family, his wife, or anybody?
I heard there was a note. I think one of the comments on the YouTube page was from somebody he was, I guess, a friend of his or a neighbor of his, a cousin of his in Jenin, who wrote in very good English. And but I haven't had any contact with any of his direct family members.
Mm-hmm. You know, I know that there's going to be a lot of protests against this type of detention, this type of imprisonment that Israel uses as a form of collective punishment again.
Yeah.
One of the protests is going to be at the San Francisco Israeli consulate coming up. And you said in Chicago, if I'm not mistaken, they're going to have some demonstrations in Chicago too. Are you going to be attending any of those, David?
I wish I could. I'll be. I leave for Europe on March 3rd, so or March 2nd. So, but actually, I probably will be because there's a lot of Israeli consulates in Europe. So, a lot of times when Israel when the IDF attacked the Turks and others in the Mavi Marmara a couple years ago, I at that time I was in Copenhagen, so I wrote a song about that, and I sang at a protest in Copenhagen one day and a protest in Malmö, Sweden the next day, or actually the same day, which is easy enough to do. It's only 26 miles apart on a bridge, but yeah, there's lots of Israeli consulates there to protest.
Well, oftentimes, one of the things that I find interesting is that here in the United States, the land of the free and the home of the brave, we don't often speak out like we should. And yet all over the world, people are talking up a storm about this issue. They are not afraid of Israel like we are here.
Yeah, it is. It's a really different reality in most of the world compared to the U.S. I mean, the U.S., Israel, and Germany are the three countries where it's really, especially in Germany, but also, you know, very much in the U.S. and very much in Israel. So these are the places where even progressives are divided around what they think of Israel and Palestine and the occupation and everything else. In the entire rest of the world, the whole debate was if there was a debate, it was over several decades ago, you know, and everybody came down on the side of the Palestinians, except it seems for, you know, the people running the country, you know, it's because, of course, if the people running many different governments had the same politics as so many of the citizens, then there'd be a lot more countries refusing to trade with Israel, which is what needs to happen.
Exactly. We do have a question from one of our listeners. Barry in Australia asks, David, are your children's shows activist as well, or what kind of content are in your children's shows?
Well, people actually can listen to all my music, for my grown-up music and my children's music, for free on my website, so they can find out directly what it's about. But my children's songs, I've got two albums of children's songs, and they're like, I guess a majority of the songs, I would say, are not even remotely political, but a good handful of them kind of take on social issues from a small child perspective. And I have a six-year-old girl, so that's kind of where my propensity for writing children's songs came from. But there's like one song is called Bullies, about not being, you know, how a bunch of kids banded together to tell the bullies to you know, piss off in the playground. And, you know, one song is about pirates and just about how they, you know, rob from the rich and give to the poor. It's a bit simplistic, but that's, you know, the sort of stuff that's there scattered amidst, you know, songs about boogers and falling into the toilet and stuff that kids just like that has nothing to do with politics.
Well, that's wonderful. Sounds like a lot of fun.
It is. I love doing shows for kids, if the environment is right. It's actually kind of challenging that compared to doing shows for adults, where people kind of know what is going to happen. Like, they're going to sit there and they're going to hear a concert. Whereas with kids shows, the parents have the idea that this is going to be a party. And the kids have the idea it's going to be a concert. They want to hear stories. They want to sit there and quietly and listen. But the parents often don't let them because they're talking. So it's actually something I'm pursuing too much.
Parents outside the door and let the kids come in.
What's that?
Leave the parents outside the theater door.
Yeah, if the parents would just stay out, yeah, that would be better. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like you've got a lot of fascinating things going on in your life these days, David. And I wish you the greatest success on your tour. What do you hope? And one interesting question I would like to ask you. When you wrote this song, you've written a lot of songs about Palestine. Are you surprised that this one took off?
I mean, they all different. It's always kind of pleasantly surprising if a song does take off like that, and I'm never expecting it. I'm always kind of hoping for it. So I guess I'm always like a little let down when I look at the view count. It's still under 1,000 and that sort of thing. But when it's, when it's really getting some attention, it's always a pleasant surprise. But I don't know enough to. I can never predict these things, whether a song's going to take off or not. I think most of my songs are of that kind of quality, I'd say, but I don't think that's necessarily why a song takes off. I mean, that has a lot to do with it, I'm sure, and recording quality, if it were better, that would have helped a lot, I'm sure, for this song to take off a little more. But it's always, I think, more random than anything.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm very pleased that it has. I wish you all the success in the world. Good luck on your tour. Good luck to Khadr Adnan. Yeah. Let's hope everyone keeps him in their thoughts. And if you pray, keep him in your prayers. I'm sure that he's in desperate need of them. Thank you very much for being with us, David Kovacs. And Khadr Adnan and Bobby Sands, the name of the song. Everybody go to YouTube and listen to it. Thank you, and we'll see you all next week, folks. Remember, when the people speak, we make a difference.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief of us, as summer people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering, if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land made for you and me.